we assume a condition. Now, I've known a number of individuals who, having this thought in mind, departed from this confusion of ours and entered socialized communities, small groups that had already resolved to live that way, and were, to a degree, doing so. In a few months, the new member was bored to distraction, for he gradually realized that it wasn't the pressures of his environment that caused him misery. It was the pressure in himself that caused him misery. And no matter where he went, he took it with him. Also, that in some way, his future state depended totally upon some kind of a consciousness in himself. So the Buddhist fable tells us that a great prince of India died and came to the mysterious gate that leads into the world beyond, perhaps in the older concept, the paradise of Indra. And at the door, the gatekeeper, who must have been a Buddhist, there's no question about it. In fact, there is a legend that they used Buddhists in those strategic positions. But in any event, the gatekeeper very quietly and very subtly looked at the new arrival and said, "Who are you?" The man said, "I am the Prince of India." And instantly, paradise vanished. Everything disappeared, and the prince found himself falling headlong into a new embodiment. Why? Because he had answered the question badly. When asked what he was, or who he was, he might have gotten in if he had said, "I do not know." But when he said, "I am a prince of India," he identified himself with his body and went right back to it again. Because it was also his body that was a prince of India. And if he believed that he was the prince of India, then he was merely speaking for his body. He was not emancipated. He was not free. He was still bound to such a simple thing as a title. If another man had gone there, and the gatekeeper had said to him, "Who are you?" And this man had said, "I am John Smith of Milwaukee," he probably would have fallen into re-embodiment also, because he would have identified that which was at that time separate from body with that which was body. Such is the subtlety of the fables, always working upon the principles involved. In the Northern school, the gradual rise of it resulted in the integration of a middle concept between illusion and reality. And this middle concept became the paradise of Amitabha. Now, the paradise of Amitabha was a beautiful world, a world built upon shores of gold. It was filled with flowers and trees and fountains. And the flowers were covered with jewels. And in this world were magnificent shrines and temples, and all things that were beautiful. And here, it is said, from morn till night could be heard the chanting of the Lohans, the wonderful songs of those who were dedicated to the law. And high above, or in the midst of this magnificent place, rose the wonderful gabled temple and palace of the great being Amitabha, the Lord of enlightened love. And here the souls of those who had achieved to goodness and to virtue passed after death. Now the wondrous glories of Sukarvati's halls corresponds very closely, or correspond very closely, with the Christian story of the New Jerusalem, as found in the book of Revelation. And it corresponds in the Mahayana concept with that wonderful line, that thundering edge of the razor, which divides the false and true. The paradise of Amitabha is the least of illusion. It is that state in which action, having achieved to goodness, achieves also to the positive pole of unreality, which is goodness, virtue. But it is still bound to the concept, I am good. The being says, as it departs from this life, I have kept the doctrine. I have lived the life. I have practiced the disciplines. I have attained the merit. I have done these things. Therefore, I am entitled to go to heaven. So, if it be true, and if the inner life of the individual is as truly dedicated as it would appear that it is, then according to Buddhism, this being enters into Sukhavati's halls, into the halls of the wonderful paradise that is ruled over by the radiant Bodhisattva or Buddha Amitabha. This, however, does not exist in southern Buddhism, for in that school there is only illusion and reality. Nothing can come between. Either the individual is immersed in the dream or he is awake. But the Mahayanists discovered that there are certain degrees of waking and sleeping, and that the majority of beings, so called, have not yet and cannot yet achieve the liberation, yet have merit. And for this merit, there must be the psychic karma. And this psychic karma for the doing of good is represented by the mystery of Amitabha's paradise. Here the individual is still self, but has become the virtuous self, the pure self, but has not yet consented to the supreme step, which is the recognition of the annihilation of the doer of the act. Now, Buddhism has a very subtle point also, that man only thinks that he is the performer of action. Actually, acts perform him. There is a mysterious sense in which the person is indeed the pen in the hand of the ready writer. For the doer of the action is the product of the action and not the cause of it. Now this is exceedingly subtle. Why is the doer of the action the consequence of it and not the cause of it? Because the doer of the action is suspended in the interval between dharma and karma. The doer of the action is the product of previous action and can have no other existence or nature. And in the exhaustion of the karma of the action, the doer of the action also becomes extinct. Now this is pretty subtle, but it can again be exemplified by a series of stories, of legends. Legends which circle around the various saints. Let us take one very simple one. Once upon a time, there is supposed to have been a Buddhist saint, one of the old Lohans. And this Lohan had a very great desire to visit another country. And so he decided that he would sit down and try to devise a means of getting there. So he quietly entered into meditation, and he meditated upon the fact that he required to visit another country. And upon opening his eyes after the meditation, he was in that other country. He had been moved there by desire. The simple desire produced its own fulfillment. Now, actually, probably the fable does not imply that he rode on some strange, mysterious, magical device like Dr. Faust on his way to Walpurgis Night. Actually, the point of the matter is that the individual is always in the state which is the consequence of his desire. One of the attributes of desire is mind. Therefore, it is mind that produces the person. Therefore, a man's thoughts make him. He does not make his thoughts. Therefore, in Buddhism, the thought always precedes the mind. And the thought always precedes the thinker, which to us seems an inconceivable thing, because we can scarcely conceive of a mind without recognizing that that mind must be the cause of the thoughts that come from it. This would be true if the mind was a fixed entity or a fixed being. But it is not. The mind is always the product of the association or the attributes of the skandhas, or these illusionary things which keep weaving a webwork. And this webwork creates and sustains the personality. So the personality is the consequence of sensation, desire, emotion, and thought. It is not the cause of them. The personality, therefore, changes with them. And these things think the self into existence, or move the self into existence by desire, by hunger, or what Buddha called thirst. Thirst in this sense being the craving for existence. Man wishes to exist. Therefore, as long as he so wishes, he wishes his own existence into illusionary being. And the product of this is his sense of selfness. So the self cannot attain to reality because it is compounded of substances in themselves unreal. It can never sustain or survive its own nature. Now, to take another group of legends which deal with a different type of thing, we have the hero legend in Buddhism, sometimes involving the monk, sometimes involving something very close in its nature or substance to the hero legend of Europe, but with a different psychological intention. One of the outstanding hero legends, of course, is the Tibetan saga of Geza Khan, which is the tremendous story of the hero self. Now, we've already learned that the hero self is forever and inevitably vulnerable. We know that from our Nordic mysteries, from our Greek mysteries, from our Egyptian rites, that the hero is always an immortal mortal and always dies. There is always something about the hero, whether it is the spot on Siegfried's shoulder where the leaf fell and where he did not receive the immortalizing power of the dragon's blood, or whether it was the heel of Achilles, the place where his mother held him when she dipped him into the waters of immortality, the place where her hand was, was the vulnerable point. Now the hero myth, whether it is in Asia or in any other area, is always a myth of the vulnerability of the being in certain respects. For example, in your Siegfried myth, in your Dionysus myth, in your Isdubad myth, in all of these, your hero is never all-knowing. Your hero can get himself into terrible difficulties. In fact, most of the saga is the story of him extricating himself from difficulties he would never have been in if he was a totally heroic being. If Siegfried had really been the true embodied hero, he would have known that Hagen was going to drive the spear into his back. If he had been the truly perfect and complete being, he would have known that the wine was drugged, which caused him to pass into the state of a kind of hypnotic trance and lose his memory of his mission and his destiny. Had he been the true hero, he would not have been so short-sighted as to refuse to return the ring to the Nibelung, or return it, at least in the Siegfried saga, to the Rhine maidens, or to the keepers and natural custodians of the ring. But Siegfried did many foolish things, although he was the hero. So the self, which is always represented by the hero in Buddhism, is not a real first-class, A-number-one hero. It is a curious combination of hero and heel, and they always are, and they always have been. Now, in the Geza Khan cycle in Tibet, we have the same thing. Here is an individual loaded with magical attributes and powers, destined to be born a magnificent spiritual being in the Tushita heaven before embodiment, who made the gallant sacrifice for a consideration and took upon himself the embodiment. He then proceeds to do many wonderful and strange things, also many cruel and terrible things. He becomes utterly dominated by the concept of the end justifying the means, and certainly in his relationship to the problems of his peculiar embodiment, he broke every essential statute of Buddhism, yet he is the Buddhist hero. Under the story of the Geza Khan, then, we have a very subtle statement of the hero as man's magnificent concept of himself. Each one of us is heroic, except we continue to make the most rudimentary mistakes. We have sufficient knowledge to inform all except ourselves. Advice, we give it abundantly. We practice itself. We know all kinds of solutions except those we need. And with all our long-headedness, we are consistently short-sighted. We are certain of ourselves, but never certain of what we are going to do. Thus, all these legends return to us the original concept that the hero, extending objectively into the sphere of phenomena, envisions itself as the ultimate conqueror of the world, whether it be the conqueror of worldliness, whether it be the fulfillment of ambition, the accumulation of possession, the conquest of natural forces, domination over almost anything, from the moving mountain stream to the mystery of atomic fission. The hero is always the one who is going to dominate, to succeed where all others have failed, to exhibit innumerable magical attributes. And like the god Odin himself, to possess all knowledge except the knowledge of his own origin and destiny. And yet the hero inevitably dies. The hero does not achieve his end. In some mysterious and some infamous manner, his destiny, like the destiny of Hitler or Mussolini, is cut short. Like Napoleon, he ends at Alba. Like Alexander, he falls or ceases not far from Babylon. Always, this great path of glory leads but to the grave. Thus, the self, which is the symbol of the hero, is also the emblem of the ultimate frustration of man. For the one thing he cannot do, and never can do, is bestow immortality upon himself, or his self. His self cannot become that which he dreams it will be. It cannot go on and on to become godlike. And always, the attempt to expand the power of the Sattva exhausts the capacities of the energies which produced it, and therefore they can no longer direct it. It is controlled, limited, and restricted by the means and conditions of its own existence, and it cannot break that pattern. Now this would cause us to assume that the loss of self would be the end of being, but this is not the case in the Buddhist concept, especially in the Northern school. But we have in this school a series of beings called bodhisattvas. And of course, Bodhi, in this sense, means enlightened. But the word sattva is a bit of a sticker. It does not translate as easily as we might think. We can translate it self, but to do so, we must have a different concept of self from anything we have in the West. We can translate it being, but that isn't quite right. We can't translate it as an essential condition. This is not quite right. The further we go, the more of the not quite rightness we come across. And perhaps it could be conceived of as wisdom or the state of enlightened knowing, with the sattva representing the cognating power. But this isn't right, because enlightenment is not a cognating power. Perhaps then, the only way we can really get some kind of a definition that is useful is to assume that a bodhisattva represents something which has achieved the enlightenment of knowing its own becoming. In other words, it has achieved to the state where it is aware that it cannot achieve, that it has reached the exhaustion of delusion, and that enlightenment possible in a being is really not a positive light, but the recognition of basic error. Therefore, the Bodhisattva is a being or a ever-becoming much on the same level as the paradise of Amitabha. The Bodhisattva is the extension of good. It represents that state in which the recognition of unreality is totally and completely accepted, and with it, the realization that this recognition is the source of bliss, the source of absolute emancipation. It is said that the Bodhisattva is upon the earth in a final or last incarnation, and having achieved this incarnation, will not return. But let us go back now to some old Buddhist fables. There are a whole series of fables in which Buddhas of previous cycles, presumably having attained the nirvana, do come back. Now that is something that causes us a little pause. Also, the beings that have assumedly achieved the nirvana may, under certain conditions, take upon themselves the appearance of embodiment and manifest themselves for a purpose and a reason to the disciples or to a world under crisis. This implies, beyond question of doubt, from early sources, that nirvana was not a state of extinction. It was a state, however, which can be explained in the terms of Buddha's own experience. And here we can remember the Dhammapada, and also particularly the closing symbolism of the Book of the Great Decease. Here we recognize the personification or the embodiment achieving the Parinirvana through the final extinction of the ultimate karma, which consisted of the eating of the polluted meat, which meant that in this particular circumstance, the teacher had ended and paid the last bill, that there could be no further karma. Now, if this constituted then the state of the release, and the teacher or the great one passed into meditation or into a profound state of contemplation, whereby yogic power he gradually disassociated his being from his personality and finally disassociated being itself and dissolved the complex of identity. Now what, we will assume, could then happen? Assuming then that this was a step from phenomenal to noumenal condition or existence, what happens? According to the teaching, this teacher became identical with all preceding beings that had attained the nirvana. By becoming thus identical, does it mean that he became simultaneously aware of them all and simultaneously experienced them all? Would the next Buddha, achieving the same end, simultaneously experience the preceding Buddha and all others? What is the state of being or the state of essence which can be totally experiencing and still be one? This means that the whole concept of nirvana postulates a completely different state which the premise of continuance can be based. A continuance of totality, capable at any time of the experience of individuality. If such is the case, then we know how the five primordial Buddha powers can will conditioned existence into being, because they possess the total of conditioned and unconditioned. Therefore, an entirely different dimension of consciousness exists. A consciousness which is not divided, and yet being undivided, possesses universal awareness. That there is no longer the state of individual awareness. And all existing conditions of consciousness are experienced as within totality. Now, this creates another cycle of beliefs and doctrines, all of which are related to the ascent of man into this ultimate condition. In this whole concept of Buddhism, we have therefore also a great cyclic evolutionary drama, a drama which begins with the infinite and ends with it, a drama of infinite becoming, moving from the most subtle essences of space through all conditions, molecular, atomic, electronic, finally elementary, a becoming which achieves totality by the total experience of totality, and cannot be total while there is one fragment of unexperienced totality. The full and complete experience, therefore, is the same as a complete re-identification. Things are separate only by difference. All things that are different in degrees of ignorance. Therefore, when totality is experienced, there is no interval between that which experiences and that which is experienced. And totality reasserts itself. Then let us also see why, in this particular problem, every bodhisattva, every divine being, must face Mara, the principle of the ultimate compound of illusion. Gautama Buddha, seated under the tree of the great determination, from which he resolved never to rise again unless he had attained the enlightenment, was immediately subjected to the assailing of Mara. And Mara has been termed the deity of evil. More essentially, Mara is not evil. And Buddha would have been the last to accuse Mara of being evil, although we are not quite so patient in our attitude toward the devil. But the devil, archetypally and psychologically, is identical with Mara. And Mara means or signifies basically one thing. And that one thing would be termed in Buddhism sensation. Sensation, which is the root of desire. Sensation is that internal quality or attribute of the skandhas, by means of which the individual is placed in subjection to the reactions of corporeal or material existence upon the self, upon the self or the egoic complex. Mara, therefore, is sensation in the sense of man's total receptivity to stimuli. And sensation, in this case, is the basis of the thirst or hunger for gratification or satisfaction of that which is sensed or known. The sensation covers much more than the sensory perceptions, but let us use them as a symbol for it at the moment. Sight is a phase of sensation. Things seen affect us. We cannot escape from them. The moment we open our eyes into this objective state, we become the victims of the faculty of sight. It is a strange fact, but notable, that persons born blind are nearly always happy. Because being deprived of sight, they are cut off from a whole series of consequences resulting from sight. Those who have lost their sight, it is not the same, because they have already known of these things. But a person who is born blind and loves someone will always live in the beauty of that person and will never grow old and never change, because they have never been seen. Sight is one of the things that binds us relentlessly to a belief in the reality of matter. Sight sustains, and it also invites. Through sight, we suddenly observe the man with the new car. Thus, another sensation is stimulated within us, desire. And by the time sight gets through with us, it has whipped us thoroughly. It has locked us within a whole complex of attachments, of ambitions, and of instinctual and habitual practices. It has made us a copycat, for one thing. It has burdened us with the infinite necessity of watching television, which itself is little better, in most cases now, than a form of punishment. It may be better someday, it's improving, but at the moment it has much to be desired. Sight binds us to cyclic phenomena. It produces an immense verification of itself. And though we do not realize it, passions rise from sight. Appetites arise from sight. Therefore, what would happen if there was nothing to be seen? We come back to the old problem of, would there be any noise if there wasn't anyone to hear it? Supposing now there was no phenomenal universe which could be reached by the five sensory perceptions. Supposing the individual existed in a vacuum. Under such conditions, what would his state be? We've already stated it. He would exist in a vacuum. He would have no desires, no activities, no interests, no attachments, no likes, no dislikes, no ambitions, and, of course, no opportunity for temporal delight and no necessity for temporal pain. Because none of these things can have any existence in him except that existence which is called forth, as Kundry was invoked by Klingsor, called forth by externals. So externals pull out the inner energies of man, externalize them, and cause them to fashion themselves into patterns. the supreme one of these patterns being the self, which is the total of all the pressures of phenomena, and all man's reaching out to embrace the objects of desire or sensation. If then these objects were not there, the sensations within man could not operate. Now the objects are there. Therefore these internal energies operate incessantly. But man is not required merely to continue indefinitely in this procedure. He possesses the power within himself to discriminate between objects. And this is the beginning of an energy which itself rises from karma. This power to discriminate causes him to possess the ability to experience through material conditions until they no longer stimulate sensation. He cannot prevent them from existing, but he can no longer respond to them. It is like a person who perhaps will gorge himself on a certain kind of food, but presented with a food he does not like, he will not eat. Therefore, like and dislike, acceptance or non-acceptance, determines the intensity of sensations. Buddhism consequently teaches that if man firmly understands the truth about the matter, he will instinctively and inevitably relax his grip upon the sensational sphere and will gradually sublimate his instincts and appetites until he will respond gradually to only the most subtle and least gross of the phenomenal illusions, and ultimately will find supreme contentment in a complete dissociation from them. This is the monastic life. This is the way in which the old pattern was set up. Because there is no good and evil in the essential teaching, and because mara simply means this locked sensation, the arising of mara before the young prince who was to become the Buddha during the Enlightenment represents the tremendous impact of the phenomenal world and the decision that had to be made. The decision to reject the phenomenal and in this way to subdue sensation or overcome mara or illusion. And having had a victory over sensation through internal consciousness, the Buddha was then free from the material. Having achieved freedom from the material, the Buddha was then, and then only, according to the Buddhist tradition, capable of revealing the doctrine. Because he could not reveal the doctrine until he was free from what might be termed his own intent of interpretation. Sensation carries with it interpretation. And the doctrine can only be revealed by the individual who does not try to explain it, or does not try to apply it, or who does not try to interpret it in some mode, mood, or way. The revelation of the law is therefore, in its completeness, only possible to the individual who is completely disassociated from the pressure of sensation, and is therefore, as in the Hindu classic, unmoved in pain and pleasure, and thereby suited for immortality. Having thus achieved the suspension of sensation, the teacher was prepared for his mission. Now, the Buddhist legends and paintings, particularly the pictures of the 16, in some cases 18 Lohans in the Chinese group, also include this concept of the Buddha in the Golden Pagoda of the Heart, an essential element of the heart doctrine. And in this concept, the being, or the human being, is conceived of as possessing the Buddha potency within itself. Now this is, again, very close to Christianity, because the Christ in you is the hope of glory. Now the Buddha in you is tremendously and wonderfully significant, except in Buddhism, the Buddha in you is a potential. It does nothing. It does not save you. But it is the statement of your participation in totality. In other words, the Buddha in you will transform nothing, regenerate nothing, redeem nothing, because it can do no more for you than space around you, because space is also completely and fully permeated with the same power. The Buddha in your brother cannot reach you, nor can it always reach him. The Buddha in the sky, or in the sun, or in the rain. For this power is everywhere. But this power in itself, this essence, which is the essence of totality, or the potential of reality, cannot move out, cannot possess, cannot take over, because it cannot will. It cannot pity you, because it cannot have sensation. Now, to the Western mind, this sounds as though this principle was awfully, coldly impersonal. But it isn't. It cannot be sorry for you, because actually and factually, sorrow and all these things are part of the illusion. And we cannot expect reality to blaze forth with all these illusionary attributes. It does not do so. So the regeneration and redemption philosophy in the symbolism of Buddhism is not the saving power of totality saving you. It is your job to save it. Not in the sense that it can be destroyed, but in the sense that it can only be experienced by you when you have redeemed it. When you have made your own statement of totality. Up to that time, this power in you is subject to your own definition of it. One man may say that reality in him is God in him, and that this God is an ever-merciful power, seeking always his good. All that he is factually saying is that an eternal essence exists within him. The rest is his own interpretation of that. Everywhere, the human being is seeking easy ways out of his dilemmas. Nature provides none. What nature provides, however, is a certain way. A way which, strangely enough, is not difficult, and not barren, and not terrible. For as Buddha himself said, the way to the enlightenment is far easier than the path of ignorance. Actually, the individual who seeks the real is happier every step of the way than the person who does not. The sincere and devout person, therefore, does not need the compassion of an interceding power. His own conduct is forever rewarding him. It is his own sense of values that grows and bestows upon him the constant benediction of understanding. we in our ignorance cry out to be understood. The Buddha power cries out to understand. As long as we desire to be understood, we will suffer. As soon as we desire to understand, we will be relieved of suffering to that degree. And to the degree that this desire grows and matures within us, we realize that it is our task to understand totality. And in so doing, to build ever more accurate legends, fables, images, and forms of it. Until finally, transcending form, we discover universal not form to be the only appropriate form which it can take. As the doctrine says, only the unembodiedness can be the perfect body of the law. For everything else falls short of itself. Those who embody it, destroy it. But those who in themselves remove its bodies, release it. Therefore, the ever being is released to our awareness through our own understanding of it. Regeneration, redemption are in the hands of man. It is not that he should be saved in the sense of having his personality infinitely projected. It is that he should be redeemed or transformed by the illumination. An illumination being the recognition of the transitory and the unchanging. Now this does not lead to non-action. Buddha was far too practical for that. Actually, he had very little interest in trying to find definitions for the gods and Buddhas and sages and saints that had gone before. Like the famous Mephisto in Faust, he saw alone man's self-inflicted pains. How the little world god still his stamp retains, as wondrous now as on the primal day. Better, alas, for him, poor the white that ye concealed the heavenly light. Reason he named it, but doth use it so each day more brutish than the brute doth grow. That was the sorrowful wail of Mephisto at the footstool of divinity in the prologue to Faust. Actually, Buddha realized that man cannot conceive the ultimate, nor can he immediately attain it. Therefore, the problem was the immediate assistance of the individual in a way, however, which was not an illusion, or at least contributed no further to the delusion. A way which infinitely extended would lead to reality. A way of things to be done that need never again be undone. No further trial or error. Perhaps only one step, but that step in the direction of eternity. The important thing was that each step produced of itself an immediate and obvious result. Each degree of attainment of man, by means of which he achieves a victory over sensation, perception, and desire, is an immediate cause for the reduction of misery. The farmer, the householder, by achieving one correction within his nature, removes one source of sorrow. And therefore, even a fraction of 1% gain may in conduct transform a life. And the moment life is approached with this strange, deep, abiding honesty. The moment an individual begins to realize that he does not have to do a thing because he feels like it. The moment he realizes he does not have to make a mistake because he can't help it. The moment he realizes that it is perfectly possible to achieve a gradual relaxation of attachments so that he can use without possession. As each step of the way brings with it a corresponding weakening of the power of illusion over living, the individual gains a new tranquility, a new perspective, a new tolerance. The mere recognition that the end of life is not success but enlightenment helps to make the man a better father, a better husband, and a better son. It relaxes him away from the terrifically psychotic intensity of living for the gratification of sensation. He begins to know that in this gratification there is nothing but darkness and death. That no matter what he does, he is causing consequences which he must endure. His first and natural move, therefore, is not to suspend all action. He cannot, because no man can do nothing until that is the only thing that remains to be done. He can never arrive prematurely, because he can never suspend action until the last cause of action ceases. What he can do, however, is moderate action. He can also recognize the importance of the choice of those things which are better, so that consequences are calmed. Pulling the sattva back into embodiment brings it into an embodiment of reward rather than punishment. That the being can gradually increase in good works, and in so doing achieve a higher level within this continuing structure of illusion, and that each such advancement can be distinguished by a notable improvement and alteration in character and temperament. Most of all, Buddhism insists that these steps must be the voluntary decision of the individual. He will never overcome illusion until it is the thing which he most desires to do. This desire becomes, therefore, the bodhisattva of the skandhas of desire. In other words, recognizing a series of illusionary concepts which go together, the five illusions which go together to make the personality, each one of these illusions can reach its own apex and have its own last illusion. The last illusion of passion is compassion. Therefore, it is a bodhisattva, the last embodiment.